We will hear argument first this morning in case 25-112, Chatry versus United States. Mr. Unikowski?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the government conducted a search of petitioner's location history, and the warrant that purported to authorize that search violated the Fourth Amendment. The government conducted a search. The Court should hold that people have a property interest in their data, in their accounts on the cloud. Location history has the core attributes of property. Petitioner had a right to exclude, to control, and to destroy. Additionally, petitioner had a reasonable expectation of privacy in his location history, given both its sensitive and revealing nature and the fact that it was stored in his password-protected account. The warrant violated the Fourth Amendment. The warrant authorized the government to direct Google to search every single person's account to find those people who were within the geofence. That is a general warrant. Even if the search materialized only when the data was found and exposed to the police, the warrant would still be unconstitutional because there was not probable cause to search the virtual private papers of every single person within the geofence merely because of their proximity to the crime. Finally, at step 2 and step 3, the search violated the Fourth Amendment because the warrant gave the police unlimited discretion to decide who to search while casting Google into the role of magistrate. I welcome the Court's questions.
How exactly did the warrant violate petitioner's rights at the Fourth Amendment rights at step 1?
So at step 1, we understand this warrant to have authorized.
I thought it was anonymized at step 1.
That's true. So from our perspective at step 1, we believe that there was a search of every single account, and alternatively, at a minimum, there was a search of the accounts of all the people whose data was exposed to Google, but either way, we view that as a search that the warrant authorized. But let me specifically answer your question about anonymity. We view the anonymity in this case as both irrelevant to the Fourth Amendment analysis and also rather illusory. So first of all, I don't think anonymity matters because I think a search is a search even if you don't know the target of the search. Like, if you go to a bank and you break open a safety deposit box, I'm sorry, Your Honor, do you have a question?
No.
If you go to the bank and break open a safety deposit box, even if you don't know who owns the box, if you inspect the papers, I still think that counts as a search. As well, as a practical matter, anonymity is somewhat illusory because one's movements within the geofence often functions as a kind of fingerprint. You can figure out who the person is based on a fairly small amount of movements. In this very case, our expert was able to identify three purportedly anonymous people via a close analysis of their movements as well as some public records.
So
if you don't want the government to have your location history, you just flip that off. You don't have to have that feature on your phone. So what's the issue?
I take the point that you can flip it off, but I guess I just don't agree that one should have to flip off one's location history as well as other cloud services to avoid government surveillance. I mean, by the same token, you don't have to send email. You can flick that off as well, but that doesn't imply that you're implicitly consenting to the government searching one's email.
Well, not implicitly consenting, but the only reason the government has access to this information is because you've decided to make it public to the extent it can be accessed by people any number of ways. In other words, people can use that information, not simply law enforcement.
Well, I guess
it's like if you don't want them to peer into your window, you can close your window or the shades.
I take the point, Your Honor, but I guess I'd respectfully disagree with that assessment for a couple of reasons. So first of all, I think you could say the same thing about, sending mail. If you don't want the government to look in your mail, you don't have to send it and give it to the Postal Service, or the same thing with a safety deposit box. But I think that, one should be permitted to hand over data to a third party without assuming the government is going to look at it, especially since, it's true in this case petitioner was convicted of the crime, but geofence warrants mostly ensnare innocent people. In this case, you had 19 people within the geofence whose data was exposed, as well as two other devices whose actual identity was exposed, and Google received 9,000 of these warrants in 2019. So I don't think an innocent person should have to shut off these services as a condition of not being surveilled.
Do the numbers make a difference? Would it matter if only 1% of users enabled location history?
I don't think it should matter. The government has made a point about the fact that only one-third enabled it, but I actually don't think those matters really are significant. Because if you view a person as having a property interest in the data, in other words, if you treat one's account as kind of a virtual safety deposit box, then I don't think it matters how many people have these virtual safety deposit boxes. Even if it's only one, if the legal relationship to the data is similar to the legal relationship between someone who sends a package.
Mr. Unikowski, it's not just a question of shutting, it's not a question of shutting it off. It's a question of turning it on. And according to the government, your client had to go through multiple steps in order to turn it on. So he voluntarily disclosed to Google the information about where he was going to be.
So if I can make 2 points about the voluntariness argument that the government advances. So first of all, I actually don't think it should matter for Fourth Amendment purposes that there was voluntariness, because it's quite common for people to consent to putting their data in the cloud, in the sense of every time you send an email or you send a document, have a Google Calendar entry, all those things you're consenting it to sending it in an encrypted fashion from your phone to the cloud. But I don't think that the consent merely to have your data stored in this virtual storage locker in and of itself is consent to disclose
to the government. Well, he not only turned it on, but had he read his contract with Google, he could see that Google retained the right to turn this information over to law enforcement if it thought that that was appropriate.
That is the same provision that exists for everything that you store in Google servers, including email and documents and everything else. So it seems to me if you're going to accept that argument, then that is really the end of the Fourth Amendment for any private document you're storing with Google.
Suppose Google put that warning in red and it flashed a lot and it was totally noticeable. You know, we can give this to the government. Would that make a difference?
If there is a flashing warning saying that, you know, we reserve the right to give for any reason whatsoever, I think that might be more pertinent to the property theory than the privacy theory, because on the privacy theory, you know, the court said in the Byrd case that, you know, terms of use aren't necessarily dispositive. They should look at sort of general expectations. I mean, maybe if it was like really flashing and saying, like, we are the government's partner, we give data to the government all the time, you know, maybe that would result in a different analysis based on one's reasonable expectations. Under the property theory, it might be relevant, because one of our arguments here is that the terms of the bailment are that Google could possess this information but couldn't necessarily turn it over. There was a strict privacy policy, so it wouldn't turn it over to advertisers.
That privacy policy, the terms of service, pretty much, and I'm paraphrasing here, we will respond to lawful requests from the government. I don't know whether one even needs to say such a thing. Right? I mean, it's anybody who gets a warrant and a lawful warrant has to comply with it. And a bank, a doctor, a lawyer, anybody. So it doesn't seem to me to add a great deal to the analysis. And are the terms of service here materially different than they are for email and for Google documents?
So as to the first point, I agree, and actually the U.S. Postal Service has the same provision in their terms of use. We'll comply with search warrants, but I think a search warrant is still needed there. And on the second point, no. The general language that that Google will comply with search warrants and that Google will, you know, reveal aggregated information, like what's the most searched term of last year, it turns out it's YouTube, like that type of disclosure, that applies to all data that's stored at Google, not just location.
So if we were to rule that there was a voluntary exposure here to Google that allows the government unfettered access to it, that ruling would pertain equally to email.
That's correct. Essentially, all of your data on the cloud, which is kind of all of your data, if you use a computer, would be exposed to government searches without a warrant.
So where do you think voluntariness matters and where not? And what you're suggesting is really that's the wrong question here. When is it the right question and when is it the wrong question?
So I think there might be a voluntariness issue when it's very clear from the interaction that you really are consenting to the other person doing whatever they want with it, such as when you give information to someone knowing that the someone is going to use it as a business record. So I think that the Miller case, for example, we're certainly not disputing the holding of Miller. And in the Miller case, the court explained that if you put a check into the stream of commerce, okay, so you give it to a vendor, and then the vendor gives it to their bank, and then their bank gives it to your bank, and it becomes their business record, you can't control it. They keep it for their purposes. You can't delete it. You have voluntarily put something into the stream of commerce, and you've sort of given up control over it in the relevant sense. And so on that fact pattern, the court said that you have relinquished an expectation of privacy. And there's a similar holding in the Smith case. The court said that when you give your phone number to the phone company, you know it's their record. They're putting it on your phone bill. They're using it for all kinds of business purposes. It's exactly like it used to be when you just talked to a telephone operator. And in that case, you're not just giving someone information, like you're mailing something, but you're like giving consent for them to treat it as theirs. And that's the fact pattern that I think the court has said that, you know, the voluntariness of that transfer of property is sufficient to say that you've given up your reasonable expectation of privacy as well as your property interests.
Mr. Unikowsky, I'm struggling to understand why we are hearing this case, other than the fact that at least four of us voted to take it. 14 of the 15 judges on the en banc Fourth Circuit voted to affirm. 9 relied on the good faith exception. Unless you think that we're going to say something that convinces, that unless you think we are going to say no reasonable officer could believe that this was a valid warrant, or we're going to say something that will convince the judges on the Fourth Circuit to reach that conclusion, what you're asking for is an advisory opinion. That's number one. This involves a Google feature that doesn't exist any longer. That's number two. It involves a warrant that is structured in a particular way. That's number three. We are all free to write law review articles on this fascinating subject. But that seems to be what you're asking for. Asking for basically a law review article on a subject that it is largely unexplored by our precedents.
So let me tick through each of those points, Your Honor. So first of all, as to the good faith exception, the Court did not grant certiorari on that question, and so we didn't brief it. So all we'd ask for in this case is, if the Court finds a Fourth Amendment violation, to reverse and send it back to the Fourth Circuit to consider the good faith issue in view of this Court's guidance. Now, I admit it's going to be hard for us on the facts of this case to say that the officer acted maliciously or that the legal issues are obvious. I think if there's anything obvious from the briefs in this case is that they're not obvious. We would make a different argument. We'd say that the Leon good faith exception applies to fact-bound challenges to probable cause determinations in a particular case and shouldn't apply where we're challenging a new and fundamentally different type of warrant. And if you look at Leon, there's some language in there that says that the exclusionary rule, even in cases of warrants, should be considered on a case-by-case basis, and exclusion is warranted in the unusual context where it would advance the purposes of the exclusionary rule. So we'd just like a chance to make that case in the Fourth Circuit with the benefit of the Court's guidance. In terms of the issue that Google has discontinued the sensor vault and has put the data onto people's phones, first of all, this was fully ventilated at the certiorari stage. I don't think that there's any surprises that are in the merits briefs in this case. I think this is an important subject because lots of providers store data, not just Google. There's something like 30 amicus briefs or 29 amicus briefs in this case, including by many of the titans of the tech world. And so I think a lot of people think that this case will have implications beyond these particular facts. So we'd urge the Court to decide the question on which it granted certiorari.
Well, we can affirm on any ground that would support the judgment and was raised below, and the good faith exception qualifies on all those points. So the fact that the Court did not grant certiorari on the good faith exception does not preclude any of us from relying on that.
I'm not sure I agree. The Court specifically declined certiorari on that question, so we didn't brief it. And we raised in our cert petition that we'd like the chance to argue that the questions are intertwined, and in view of a holding on the Fourth Amendment issue, we'd like to, you know, litigate the good faith issue. The Court didn't grant certiorari. We didn't brief it. The government did have a section of the respondent's brief addressing the good faith exception, but adhering to the Court's decision not to grant certiorari, we didn't respond in the reply brief except to ask for a remand. So,
well, that was your choice.
The Court did not grant certiorari. We were reluctant to brief a question on which the Court specifically declined.
Well, you're an experienced advocate. You understand that we can affirm on an issue that was raised below and would support the judgment.
Look, I'm happy to argue the issue from the podium, Your Honor. I'll just say one word about it. I think that the premise of Leon is that it's not necessary to apply the exclusionary rule in a case of a fact-bound challenge to a probable cause determination in a particular case, because probable cause is litigated all the time outside the context of warrants. Whereas in an issue like this, a challenge to a fundamental new type of warrant, I do think litigants need an adequate incentive to litigate the constitutionality of such warrants, and the only way that'll happen is through the exclusionary rule. And there is some language in the Davis case that adverts to holding that in cases where you need an adequate incentive to litigate an issue, the Court would consider applying the.
And Mr. Unikowski, isn't there also a pretty significant split, even within the Fourth Circuit, over the issue of whether or not there was a search in this context? I mean, my understanding is that the Fourth Circuit split evenly, 7-7, on that pretty significant issue.
That is correct. It was 7-7 with one judge declining to reach the issue. So obviously there's some important issues that go well beyond the particular facts of this case. And there's also some important issues in terms of the constitutionality of the warrant that go well beyond the facts of this case.
Counsel, I just want to button down some of your answers. The privacy policy that the person is giving consent to would affect, you said, Internet, but it would also affect Google Photos, which have to do with what photos you take and store in your device, correct?
Correct.
Google Documents, what documents you store.
Correct.
Google Calendar, your entire calendar. If this is consent, that means the government can seek those documents for any reason, not just the commission of a crime, or no reason, correct?
Correct. It would not be a search, so no search warrant would be required.
So that means the government, a police officer, randomly, who decides, I don't like that person, let me just go look at their life to see if I can find the crime, that would be okay.
There might be some constraints under the Stored Communications Act, but as far as the Fourth Amendment is
right,
concerned,
but
no.
That's not at issue here.
Correct.
All right. And that wouldn't be for other things.
Correct.
For some of these things, like calendar entries.
So there might be a question as to whether calendar entries are protected as a statutory matter, but again, we're here under the Fourth Amendment.
And
so
we can't ignore today that the district court made findings that the consent here was not necessarily voluntary.
There are findings that at midnight when you're saying, yes, I'm in, to try to get your phone to work correctly, that may not be a consent to the government.
And there are certainly Google documents that show that it's very hard, and if not opaque, to figure out how to turn these things off, correct?
Yes.
Now, let's go to your general warrant theory. I understood at the founding a general warrant was, I have a crime, and a magistrate permitting you to go willy-nilly anywhere you want, to anyone you want, to search them. I thought that was the purpose of general warrant, correct?
Yes.
That's not what this does. This identifies a place, a crime, a limited time frame, but a time frame. So it's not a general warrant in its historical sense. Why isn't this closer to the warrants that we've permitted with beepers, where we don't have a person or necessarily a place in mind, but we have a location and general things? Why isn't that more consonant with Berger, Zucker, Caro, those lines of cases? And
sure,
that didn't identify a person, but it identified a crime, a place, and the nature of the unlawful conduct that we were looking for.
Sure. So let me say a few words as to why I think this should be considered a general warrant, and then a few words about why the warrant was defective, even if you disagree with me on the first few words I say. So first of all, I think the right way to think about this search is to say, one, that Google, because it received a search warrant, was acting as the agent of the government, and two, that Google really did search every single person's virtual private safety deposit box. So as to the first part of that, this Court has said that when a third party is acting with the encouragement, endorsement, or participation of the government in executing a search warrant, that third party
Can I pause you there?
Yes.
It wasn't Google doing it. It was a filter doing it.
Well, it was —
I mean, the filter is not the government. It's not even Google. It's a mechanical item that sorts. So why isn't — so how could that be a search? Seems to me that the only search would be handing it over to the government.
So let me say a few words.
Step one, basically.
Sure. Let me say a few words about that and then say why, even if the search is the handing over, the warrant is still defective. So as to the first part, you're absolutely right. There's not a human being sifting through 500 million people's accounts. That would take an extremely long time. At the end of the day, it was a piece of software that was going through every account, piercing, from our perspective, every virtual safety deposit box and checking inside to see whether the person was there that day. So I still think that when you're using software to search someone's phone, which is how any kind of digital search operates today, that's still a type of search because it's using a tool in order to detect information. And it's true that it's a tool. It's not the human being that's looking at it, but it's still a human effort to pierce a private area in order to find something that's there.
Would that mean all database searches are searches for Fourth Amendment purposes?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That is not our position. I think this is a unique case because Google's sensor vault really is structured like a row of virtual safety deposit boxes, individual accounts. It's indexed by account, which means you have to put in your own credentials to get to your account, and that doesn't get you to anyone else's. So it's exactly like a bank with safety deposit boxes, except it's in the cloud.
So does everything depend on how a company organizes its information?
I don't think everything depends on that. I think that this is a unique case because the fact that Google organizes its data that way is not some kind of arbitrary engineering decision. It really is essential to the security of a system with lots of private accounts to index them by account. So the technologist's amicus brief, I think, has a good analogy here. It says that it's not, you know, arbitrary that a hotel divides different people into different rooms as opposed to stacking all of the bunk beds in the lobby. Like, a hotel which divides people into different places, it's logical to have walls between them. And in this case, there's, you know, virtual walls as opposed to physical walls. But I don't think that the fact that Google could have constructed its system in a completely different and, from our perspective, inappropriate way should affect the analysis.
But finish, please.
No, please go ahead.
I was just going to say, this seems very complicated from the user's point of view. Frankly, you know, I have no idea how my data is stored and whether it's in these virtual lockers or not. And I guess one question that I have for you is, I'm struggling to decide how to think about this case. One way to think about this case is that, listen, our physical intrusion cases, our property cases require a physical intrusion, and CAT set us off on this course that when we're talking about technology, we think about it in terms of reasonable expectations of privacy. And I am, frankly, a little bit nervous, and I mean, I think the government makes this point well, I'm a little bit nervous because this is very complicated, right? Figuring out how bailments apply, what the property interest in this data is. Why not just think about this from the perspective of reasonable expectation of privacy?
That would be fine with us, Your Honor. We've offered two alternative paths. Different members of the court have articulated the, you know, the relevant test differently. I mean, in Carpenter, the court relied on reasonable expectations of privacy. We think there's two different sources here of the reasonable expectation. One is the fact that it was stored in the password-protected account. This court has said that property issues are instructive as to the reasonable expectations, even if not dispositive. So if you think it matters that this was in his password-protected account, you can say that that's pertinent to the privacy inquiry without getting into this trespass and bailment law, as well as the sensitivity of the data. Which was that issue.
Okay, well, this is pretty, so I think Carpenter, we haven't talked about Carpenter yet, is pretty on point, but this is different from Carpenter. Putting aside that this was in a password protected account, taking out of the fact that Google had the right to use this for advertising purposes, right? I mean, this was a few hours and it was a public location, and nobody has a reasonable expectation of privacy in their public observable movements. So does that make this different from Carpenter?
So I still think that even though the stretch of time was lower than in Carpenter, there is still a reasonable expectation of privacy for a few reasons. First of all, I don't think it's just the 2 hours. I think it's the forever. It's the comprehensiveness and the ability of the government to get access to really any 2-hour stretch anywhere it wants to at any point in the past. I think it's quite different from a case like Knott's where, you know, the police were following someone on a highway and they put a beeper just to enhance the quality of the visual surveillance. And so, you know, that, you know, this court in Carpenter framed the question as, are police doing what they could have done in the past? Or is this a fundamental increase in the ability of, you know, law enforcement to conduct surveillance? And here I think it is. I mean, the government has this tool. It can go any point in the past at any stretch of time. It could figure out where, all of the people rather than just one person in a particular place. And it can follow that person around. Like we see in this case of the 9 people who are of greatest interest to the government at step 1, it followed those people around outside the geofence at step 2. And I think that all of those considerations create significant privacy implications, even though it's true the initial geofence was just an hour.
But you can't raise the Fourth Amendment issues or the Fourth Amendment rights of the other people who might be captured in the geofence. So we're really just talking about your client's Fourth Amendment rights, right? I mean, because you keep pointing out, well, this swept in a lot of innocent people, sure, but really it's your client's Fourth Amendment rights that we care about here.
That's true. I just think, broadly speaking, when we're considering the privacy implications of the rule and reasonable expectations of privacy, you know, I just think it's relevant, you know, what the court's rule is, how it's going to affect, you know, third parties. I understand it's just petitioner's rights at stake, but even staying laser-focused on petitioner, you know, this was a law enforcement tool that allowed the government to determine where petitioner himself was at any point in the past.
Mr. Unick?
Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry. Are you done?
Only in public places, though.
Well, the government has taken the position in its brief that even if you're in your own house and a geofence warrant is used, the government has a footnote suggesting that there wouldn't be a constitutional violation either. Obviously, this case did involve a bank. I acknowledge that. Although, just one other word, because of the error bars, because of the confidence intervals in some of these estimates, actually, those confidence intervals may have encompassed people's homes. And, in fact, 3 of the people within the geofence went to their houses and were possibly identified by our expert.
So I wanted to invite you to finish your answer to Justice Sotomayor when you said you tried to defend the general warrant analysis, and then you said, even if you don't agree with that, I have another point. But before you do that, let me just home in for a second on the general warrant analysis. If we take Justice Barrett's point that this is really about reasonable expectation of privacy, what about the initial sorting intrudes on anyone's reasonable expectation of privacy.
I guess I just think that when I, if I have, you know, information in a physical storage, you know, safety deposit box, I guess I think that my expectation is that no one's going to look inside for any reason, even if a tool is used, like, you know, the Kylo tool, you know, the ThermoVision, for any reason, if I have stuff inside, people won't look at it in order to conduct a law enforcement investigation. And I understand the intrusion at step one was fairly limited. It was just a computer zipping past all these accounts, just checking quickly whether they were in a particular place. But, you know, cases like Jones say that even a very small trespass is enough. But I see my red light is on. If I could just answer Your Honor's second question.
Well, why don't you wait till we get back to that? It seems to me that the exigent circumstances exception could well expand if you're right. I mean, obviously, you have situations where you know somebody in this particular crowd has, you know, snatched a child or was involved with somebody who snatched a child. In those situations, I suppose you agree that you don't have to go through a warrant process but can access the information under exigent circumstances?
I do. The Court made that very clear in Carpenter. I mean, this warrant was sought several weeks after the crime, and so any exigent circumstances, I think, argument would have gone away. Our position today is not intended to undermine any well-recognized exception to the warrant.
Well, my question is whether intended or not, whether it could be used to expand it a great deal. I mean, what's exigent can be expanded if, in fact, it makes sense. It's when you have you don't have this much access, you can't – doesn't do any good to say, you know, okay, you know, you have to search to find out who all these people are, but if the push of a button you can find out who they are, that might give you more opportunities to avail yourself of the exception. And I don't know which way that cuts, but it does seem to me that it might undermine privacy interests further or cut the other way in sense of giving you more opportunities to perhaps catch people who are, you know, planted a bomb or whatever.
Look, if there's an ongoing emergency with a bomb, I mean, we're not going to argue against the use of these law enforcement tools, even if there might be, you know, a significant amount of privacy violations. And so, yeah, I mean, this can be a potentially useful tool in the case of a bona fide exigent circumstances. We're certainly not challenging that, Your Honor.
Justice Thomas, anything further? Justice Alito?
Justice Kagan asked you whether this would apply to all searches, all digital searches. Let me go back to the pre-digital era. It's not at all uncommon. It was not at all uncommon for a grand jury to issue a subpoena requiring a company to turn over a category of particularly described documents. But that, for the company to find those documents, required a search through a vast store of hard copy documents. What's the difference between this situation and that situation?
So I don't think a grand jury subpoena or any kind of subpoena would have been constitutionally permissible in this case.
Well, I know you say that, but what is our test for determining when a grand jury subpoena violates the Fourth Amendment?
So I think there's two circumstances when it does. One is when the holder of the documents are really a bailee of someone else's documents. So one example would be a grand jury subpoena directed at the Postal Service or FedEx, asking it to open every single package or piece of mail to find a piece of data. Or, you know,
when it's the company's own documents.
Right. So when it's the so, of course, as we've said, we don't think that's this case. But when it's the company's own documents, I just go back to the test in Carpenter, which is there's a narrow category of cases in which a person will have a reasonable expectation of privacy in business records held by a company, and in that category of cases, the subpoena is unconstitutional.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, in Carpenter, what seemed to be a very important feature, I think maybe a dispositive feature, was that the information that was sought was information that the user of the cell phone had no choice but to disclose because the cell phone tower location is an indispensable feature of actually using your phone. That is not the situation here.
I take the point that it's possible to function in society without having location history enabled, although, you know, it's actually quite hard to function without having anything in the cloud. I'd say virtually everyone in this room has at least something in the
cloud. Well, but we're not talking about everything in the cloud. We're talking about location history.
Right. It's actually quite hard.
On an Android phone where you have to take a number of steps in order to disclose it.
So
you have to choose to disclose it.
I take the point that you have to click yes, I'm in order to enable location history on your Android phone or any other type of phone. But first of all, if you agree with us that this is a personal record and not a business record, that argument just doesn't matter because you make the choice to enable email or put documents or photographs into the cloud. You're choosing to send that photograph, but that choice shouldn't undermine the Fourth Amendment protection, just like your choice to put something in the mail.
Well, you think this is not a commercial record? Why do you think Google compiles this, keeps this information? It does it so it can sell advertisements.
No, Google itself takes the position that these are not business records. I understand it's just a third party's view, but, you know, it's unusual for a company to refuse to say that something's its own records. You know, unlike with CSLI, you have total, as Your Honor said, you can turn it on, you can turn it off, you can delete all of it anytime you want, you can delete part of it. It's really unlike something like CSLI in which you have the business keeping the records for its own purposes.
Counsel, I'm sorry, are you
there?
No,
you're on.
I want to go back to Justice Barrett's question. If you're not through, Sam, I thought you were through.
Go ahead.
To go back to Justice Barrett's question. When the police are searching or asking for a search result, there's no way to predict whether they're going to invade your privacy, correct?
That's right. Searches are determined ex ante.
Regrettably, because people take their phone now everywhere, including I suspect some people to the bathroom. You really have no idea what information, private information, because it'll follow you to a brothel. It'll follow you to a cannabis shop. It'll follow you to just about anywhere where there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, correct?
Yes.
And so it really doesn't matter. I don't think the time is important, correct?
I agree with that.
So whether it's a minute that you're searching for or 6 weeks, it's not the time that's at issue. It's whether or not private information in which you have a reasonable expectation of privacy will be sought, correct?
Yes.
That's why Justice Scalia said it didn't matter for Fourth Amendment purposes to search the heat waves emanating from your house. Because though it's not giving out private information, you can't know in advance what it's going to disclose, correct?
Yes.
All right. Now, let's go to that more important part of the question that Justice Barrett asked, which is, we didn't answer this question in Carpenter, but I don't see how its logic may time the defining characteristic. Could you explain why not?
Sure.
It seemed to me that particularity has nothing to do with time. It has to do with the relationship of time to the circumstance that justifies the need.
Right. So there's two questions about time, one of whether there's a search at all, and then the second question of whether the warrant was sufficiently particularized. So as to the first question, I don't think the time period should matter as to the search because, you know, I don't think the court should be in the business of drawing lines between 7 days and 2 days and 24 hours, especially since the government gets to choose the time interval. So 2 hours at a place selected by the government really can reveal a lot.
Sure, but the government in setting forth the warrant has to give a reason for why that 2 hours is reasonable. Correct?
Of course. So that gets to the question of particularization, and that goes to the warrant. And I would like to say a few words about what the court should do if it doesn't agree with me that this is a general warrant in which all tens of millions of people were searched. We still think there is a Fourth Amendment violation because there wasn't probable cause to search all 19 people within the geofence merely because of their proximity to the crime. I get the fact that a time period was specified.
Well, Google itself said that to them, and I don't know why we would say it's okay to rely on Google to do that. They moved it from 19 to 9, wasn't it?
That was at step 2, Your Honor.
Oh, step 2. Okay.
Yes, but at step 1, 19 people's information was exposed merely because they were near the scene of the crime. And so I don't think that the problem, you know, I understand that the warrant specified a time period, but the particularity requirement in the Fourth Amendment requires particularity as to what is searched. And I don't think that there is, certainly I don't think there's particularization here when the warrant just said, whatever unspecified number of people are in the proximity of the crime, those are the people to be searched. I don't think that's a particularized description of what is to be searched. And I think there's a probable cause here, problem here, because the fact that someone's near the crime doesn't create probable cause to search their diary, and we view this as the functional equivalent of a search of their diary.
Justice Kagan?
Can I ask you to explain that a little bit more? Because You were saying that this was the answer if we rejected your categorical argument. Is that correct?
If you reject our argument that there's been a search of millions of people, then yes.
Yeah, but functionally, isn't that argument going to be the same? In other words, it's going to prevent the government from doing this kind of search in order to get these 19 people?
Not necessarily. So sort of a narrow argument would be that if there's probable cause to really believe that every single person in the geofence has relevant information, then, you know, that's a stronger case for the government. So that might come up, for example, suppose there's a murder in the woods and it's 3 a.m. and there's, you know, one criminal and one victim, and you draw a circle around that, and there really is probable cause to think that every single person in that circle is either the murderer or the victim, then maybe the government can say there's probable cause that every person whose data is exposed to the government in that case will have relevant evidence. That's not the case here, where the geofence encompassed the bank and the church. And in fact, most of the 19 people were just sitting at church the whole time. So that would be a narrower way to invalidate this warrant that wouldn't necessarily impugn all geofence warrants like this one.
Thank you.
Justice Gorsuch?
So if in this case the geofence had encompassed just the bank, perhaps?
Right. So, I mean, our as the court knows, we still think there's a general warrant. We still think that everyone's storage lockers is being searched. But if, and we also think there's
there might be probable cause to think that everybody in the bank might have some information.
Right. That's right. If you can draw a small enough geofence at a small enough time interval that everyone there either committed the robbery or witnessed it, then you might say there's probable cause that everyone has relevant information. I still would say there's a particularity requirement. I'd still talk about a general warrant, but yes, that defect in the warrant wouldn't exist in that.
Right. And Google can track you down to several feet, right?
That's right. Correct. 3 meters, Your Honor.
Yeah. And then in terms of the timing and on the search side that we've discussed, the fact that the government peeks in your mail for just a quick second or looks through your safety deposit box or your hotel room or your diary for just a minute, that's a search, right?
Yes.
Under either property or a reasonable expectation.
That's correct.
Talk with me for a minute about the Stored Communications Act and the government's responses.
Sure. So we believe that a warrant was required under the Stored Communications Act. We didn't file a motion to suppress on that ground because suppression isn't an available remedy, but that may be pertinent to the question of a reasonable expectation of privacy, because people have an expectation the government will get a warrant if there's a statute that requires the government to get a warrant, and there's also a private cause of action on the table. The government takes the position that possibly the Stored Communications Act doesn't require a warrant because the cell phone is a tracking device. I mean, if that's true, then anything that's transmitted from the cell phone into storage, your email if you're sending it from your phone or a photo or anything else, all of that would be information transmitted by a tracking device, and none of that would be protected. So I don't think that's a tenable way of getting around the Stored Communications Act. And so precisely because Congress has acted, and from our perspective, required a warrant, and in fact, in this case, a warrant was obtained, albeit one that we don't think complies with the Fourth Amendment, you know, I think that weakens the force of the government's argument that we should defer to Congress, because Congress has actually said that a warrant is needed here. And, you know, implicitly, we think that the Stored Communications Act requires a warrant that complies with the Constitution, and in this case, in our view, it did not.
How about the question of whether it's content versus a record?
So the government hasn't disputed that this is content. It's not metadata. It's not a record. Because the content at issue here, it's not just something about a communication, like I was in this place when I sent this email.
It is the location.
It is the location. Like the reason you're transmitting this to Google is for it to store where you were in order to create your timeline. So this is content, and the government actually doesn't dispute that.
And talk to me about Virginia and other similar statutory laws in this area.
So Virginia has a statute, the Virginia Computer Crimes Act, that defines data on a computer network to be a form of property. It creates criminal liability for trespasses. It also creates civil liability for malicious trespasses. And so, you know, we view the question of whether a property interest exists to be one of federal law, like the court held in the Tyler versus Hennepin case. You know, the court should consider a common law rule, not state by state. But I think state law is a pertinent input into that ultimate federal question. And the fact that Virginia and many other states have explicitly recognized data as a type of property and have created statutory torts for trespass on that data is, I think, pertinent to the Fourth Amendment question.
Okay. Now, we could bypass the search question if we just resolve the case in your favor on one of the particularity grounds, right?
Well, I think the government would say that if it's not a search at all, it didn't need a warrant in the first place.
Well, if we assumed it were a search,
that's
without
right.
deciding, we could just decide it on particularity grounds. And you've talked quite a lot about step one particularity problems you see. Can you talk about the particularity problems you see at step two or step three?
Sure. So I think the problem at step two and step three is that the government conducted these follow-up searches, right? So they got an extra hour's worth of information about nine people, and then they de-identified the people. But the warrant did not identify those people with particularity. It didn't even identify a means for the government to find those people. All it said was the police are going to figure out the really suspicious people, and they're going to do those extra searches. So the government says that the original warrant was a sufficient basis to de-anonymize and get the 2 hours from everybody in the geofence. So that's wrong for a couple of reasons. One is it's just clearly not probable cause to get 2 hours of information, including data outside the geofence, merely because someone was, like, sitting in church within an hour of the crime. And second, even the geofence warrant itself doesn't authorize that. It doesn't say the police can go ahead and collect data from everybody. All it says is that once the police winnows down the 19 or however many there are to some smaller number, then it can collect additional data. But that's not particularized because it doesn't say how to identify those people.
Would that be a narrow basis on which to resolve this case?
That would be a very narrow basis. I mean, I would caution the court that if the court resolves the case on that basis, then in future cases, the government can cure the problem here by just obtaining another warrant before step two, which may be the answer, but, you know, that would be a particularly narrow way of resolving the case. Obviously, we have concerns with step one as well, and so, you know, we believe that's unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Mr. Kavanaugh?
assuming it's a search for purposes of this question and that I don't buy your general warrant argument, how can you overcome searcher for purposes of your argument that it's not sufficiently particularized, et cetera?
Okay. So I view searcher as answering a very different question in this case. So searcher holds that the Fourth Amendment permits a search of a premises of someone who is not implicated in the crime at all, as long as there's probable cause to believe that there's evidence on those premises that will be pertinent to the criminal investigation.
And not here we have that.
We do, but okay. What we understand to have happened here is more like a search of, you know, 19 separate safety deposit boxes rather than one single place, the Stanford University office, like in Zurcher. So I guess, you know, here would be a relevant physical.
Why do you characterize it that way? It doesn't seem that way to me. It's search of one place.
Well, the argument the government would make is that Google, like the expansive entirety of Google servers, are a single place. I think that's a pretty dangerous holding, because if the court were to reach that,
we're talking about a warrant that's sufficiently particular here. So it is
right.
A search and for purposes of this question, but it really just boils down to, I think, is the warrant sufficiently particular?
Right. So if the court considers Google.
So we have probable cause. You admitted that correctly. And it's just then, is it sufficiently particular? And it seems like Detective Hilton here, you know, really went through a lot of the steps that should be applauded and in terms of narrowing this down, going through multiple steps. I guess I'm trying to figure out why this was bad police work to get a warrant. A lot of Fourth Amendment cases, we say, get a warrant. Well, they got a warrant. And then you're saying, you know, it's not sufficiently particular, but he went multiple steps. How many names were ultimately given to the detective?
Well, it was three devices, Your Honor.
Three names. So in the end, three names. You're talking about millions and millions, but it was three names in the end.
So, first of all, I'm not casting any aspersions whatsoever on Detective Hilton. There's no sign of any kind of malice whatsoever. That's not our argument today. Okay. We do think that the warrant was defective, and if I could just make a couple points about your questioning. So first of all, I understand a warrant was obtained here, but the court should be realistic about how much protection the warrant requirement really provides in a case like this. Sorry, Your Honor.
Well, that's what the Fourth Amendment says, so
I know.
Keep going.
Right, so the warrant requirement.
The Fourth Amendment's a floor, not a ceiling of protection, and the warrant requirement, we have to stick with the words of the Fourth Amendment and
absolutely.
The history of it.
All I was going to say is that the government obtained a warrant merely because someone was holding a cell phone near the scene of a crime, and if that's enough to obtain a warrant, it's going to be obtainable in a wide number of cases. That's not just a factual quirk about this case. That's many cases in which this type of warrant is obtained.
But
I'm happy to stick with the
geographically and temporally limited, though, the warrant.
Yes, but the Fourth Amendment.
In a way that the magistrate, a third party, not the executive, not the law enforcement, will neutrally review and oversee, and lots of times judges will force the warrant to be narrowed, right?
Your Honor, the Fourth Amendment requires particularity as to the place to be searched. In this case, the geofence was not the place to be searched. The place to be searched was these Google accounts.
So suppose we have a murder and we know, all the police know is that the murder was at a restaurant, a particular restaurant. And so the search is for, the request is for everyone who dined at that restaurant in a 2-hour period and for the names of those people. Thoughts?
So if the court doesn't buy the argument about a general warrant.
Correct.
Okay, then it is possible that you might say that there's probable cause that people who were actually witnesses to the crime, they were at the restaurant when the crime was committed. You might say there's probable cause to believe that there's relevant evidence in all of those people's accounts. Here, we don't have that. So first of all, I view this as a search of —
Well, let me ask, alter the hypothetical, or maybe, all you know is the murderer was in the restaurant and the search warrant or subpoena, the search warrant is to the restaurant for the list of people. To the restaurant for the list of people who were in there in a 2-hour period.
That's that is perfectly fine. A subpoena or even a search warrant could be issued.
And that's different from this. How?
That's right, because we view that as not a search of one entity's property, like one single piece of paper containing a list. We view this more as a search of 19 different people's private papers. Ultimately, the question is the Fourth Amendment.
You only got three names, but
well.
And do you agree, with Zurcher though? There's nothing from Zurcher you're asking, including the footnote. There's nothing from Zurcher you're asking us to depart from?
Correct.
Okay. And you had, this is just more practicalities, but the local government amicus brief and the 31 states amicus brief, which has a huge spectrum of attorneys general on that amicus brief, which I think Warren's note, talk about the practical consequences of not being able to solve murders. A lot of, you know, a huge percentage of murders are never solved, for example, and violent crimes. Just want you to respond to that.
Sure. So first of all, we're not suggesting that all law enforcement techniques that allow the police to determine everyone within a particular area are inherently unconstitutional. We think this particular technique of serving geofence warrants on Google and requiring searches of a sensor vault, we do think there's a constitutional violation there. But there's many other law enforcement techniques that deploy modern technology that would not present the same types of issues. And the other point is
such
that —
Such as?
So we haven't taken a position on the constitutionality of tower dumps. That presents a very different set of issues because that cannot be conceptualized as the search of lots of virtual storage lockers. There are other Fourth Amendment arguments on the table there, but I don't think anything the court says in this case would impugn the constitutionality of tower dumps. Similarly, I don't think anything the court says in this case would impugn the constitutionality of things like taking security videos, CCTV, and using those to identify suspects. So there are a lot of other law enforcement techniques that are available to solve crimes in which you know where the crime happened, but you don't know who it is. And we're not challenging those. We're just challenging this one unique particular type of method. And the other thing is, you know, Professor Kerr's brief points out that there's actually quite a lot of geofence warrants that have been issued. Like the district court says there was 9,000 geofence requests issued to Google in 2019. And there's actually a fairly small number of reported cases involving motions to suppress. So it seems empirically that most geofence warrants just ensnare innocent people because I guess maybe criminals turn off their phones when they go commit bank robberies most of the time. And so, you know, the law enforcement benefits of this particular technique, I think it's easy to overstate, even though obviously in this case —
Well, the local government brief disagrees with you on that, but
there's a lot of amici —
And they have specific cases, but I'll leave it there.
I think our side has some philosophical diversity from the amici as well. So I think both sides have a lot of people with different views on this.
Thank you.
Justice Barrett?
Mr. Unikowsky, would there have been a Fourth Amendment problem if the police had purchased this data from Google?
I don't think the police could have theoretically done that.
Why?
Because Google's policy is that it doesn't sell this data. It has a pretty strict privacy policy where it doesn't give the data away unless —
But it could. I mean, I'm just looking at the policy, and it says that Google may share non-personally identifiable information publicly and with our partners, advertisers, publishers, rights holders, specific partners to collect information from your browser or device for advertising purposes.
Right. No, So Google shares aggregated information like, you know, how many people searched for the word YouTube last year and things like that.
But doesn't it share location information too? I mean, I feel like I get ads when I'm in particular places. I mean, I need to check my location services settings, plainly. Not that I'm going to commit crimes, but it seems to me
I suggest you have IT do it.
It does seem to me like Google does give your information away.
I don't think it does. I think there are other
less
scrupulous apps.
Okay, well, maybe it doesn't as a practical matter, but that policy, as I read it, does permit Google to do it.
I don't think it does. There's There's declarations in the record that says that Google doesn't do it, and the privacy policy says that it's not going to share individual data with advertisers. I think what you read is not a reference to location history. I'm not sure what – I don't think it is, Your Honor. There's a declaration in the record, and there's live testimony, and there's a statement in the privacy policy that Google only does not share individual data with advertisers. It just doesn't do that. Like, an advertiser cannot go to Google and say –
okay, what if it did? What if it violated its own privacy policy and allowed the police to purchase it? Isn't that a problem between, like, the – person who has the Google account and Google? Would that be a Fourth Amendment problem?
It might not be a Fourth Amendment problem because there's like the private search doctrine. Even if someone unscrupulously but privately takes someone's data and illegally gives it to the government, you might call that a private search.
But doesn't Google have, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is, doesn't Google have some right? I mean, Google can dip in and dip out, at least under the policy as it existed at the time this search or this possible arguable search occurred.
We view this as just like FedEx. So if you look at the FedEx privacy policy, FedEx says it reserves the right to inspect packages when it needs to do that. But I don't think that means that the government doesn't need a search warrant to inspect packages. In the same way that if you stay at a hotel, you know, the hotel reserves the right to have a housekeeping service come into your room and maybe the housekeeper will see your personal possessions, but that in and of itself is not consent to have the government do that. So likewise, yes, Google does reserve the right to analyze your data. Like if you went to a lot of ski hills, you might see a ski ad on YouTube, but I don't think that in and of itself meant you've waived Fourth Amendment protection with respect to the government seizing it without a warrant. I mean, if Google sold it, I don't think Google's even capable of that. If Google just voluntarily handed the data to the government, that might be a little bit more like the Jacobson case, but I don't think that's what we have here.
Thanks.
Justice Jackson?
So I guess I see you as making maximalist arguments about this in ways that I'm trying to understand if they're necessary to get to the point where you want to go. I thought the key issue was what makes a warrant for a search of this nature sufficiently particularized. That's one way to put it. And so, first of all, we've got Google responding in steps. We have this warrant request. The officer, according to your brief, identifies a geographic area based on where the crime took place and the time. You know, we have a bank robbery at X time. So what I'd like, says the law enforcement officer, is the location history data for 30 minutes before to 30 minutes after a 150-meter radius around the bank. Is that right? Is that
yes.
How it starts? Okay.
Yes.
And as Justice Kavanaugh points out, at the end of the day, they end up with three names. But we have a lot of steps in between in under Google's iterative process for giving the officer this information. So I guess what I don't understand is why you aren't arguing something about needing more probable cause as each one of these steps goes along. Yes.
I do think that that is one of the arguments we're advancing today, that the government did not obtain a fresh warrant before it conducted the step two search. And the initial warrant did not authorize all of the information to be obtained from all of the 2 hours of information to be obtained from everyone within the geofence.
Right.
And that, yes.
Okay. So fine. But why isn't there probable cause? You seem to be fighting the premise that at the beginning, when the search is drawn, when the fence is drawn, 150 meters around the bank, 30 minutes before and 30 minutes after, and 19 accounts are identified, setting aside your general warrant point.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be suggesting, or you're arguing, that there isn't probable cause to do anything more at that point. That something about the 19, they have to know something about a particular account. I don't understand that. Why isn't it enough to begin with to just ask as the magistrate, is your fence reasonable? Is the 30 minutes before and 30 minutes after, is a 150-mile radius? Like, why isn't the step one probable cause inquiry just, do we have a reasonable scope to begin with? I would think that we would just ask that and that the answer in this case would be yes.
Well, except for that very last step, I don't disagree. I think the answer in this case would be no.
So what's wrong with 100? Is that too wide? Is that too big? Why is that too big under these circumstances?
Well, the problem is that we view what happened at step one even before the de-anonymization happened, we view that as a search of people's private papers.
No, I understand.
And so if that's...
You said in response to Justice Kavanaugh, it's not the whole location. Justice Kavanaugh says this is Zurcher. which I think has some force to it, that we have a location and there are maybe 18 people in this 19-person search who are going to be innocent, who didn't know anything about this but just happened to be there in that time. But Zurcher seems to say that's fine as long as you have probable cause to believe that there is a crime that's being committed in this location at this point. You say, no, it's each person's individual count. If we disagree with that,
okay,
all right, if we think this is Zurcher, then why is 150 meters or 30 minutes before or 30 minutes after unreasonable at step one?
Okay. If you think it's just like Zurcher, I still think it's unreasonable at step one because I think the geofence warrant covers people who are just, you know, sitting in the church the whole time. And I think that geofence warrant that encompasses not just the bank, but also a church and a church parking lot 30 minutes before and 30
but
minutes after.
But we can't eliminate those. We don't know anything about those people. This is a reverse warrant, says Professor Kerr. You're allowed to, have the radius encompass people who aren't necessarily the bank robber if you're trying to find the bank robber and there's probable cause to believe he was there 30 minutes before or 30 minutes after. Well, eventually get those people's names. That's the point I'll get to. But for step one, I don't understand why there's a problem.
I guess that's the question, whether it's okay under the Fourth Amendment to say, well, we don't know which of those people it is, so we're just going to search all of them to try to find the suspect. Because that's essentially what happened here.
Okay, so isn't the real problem, if you're looking at it as I am, that the point that you made with Justice Gorsuch, that we don't understand how the police went from the 9 to the 19? That the next step in opening it up and looking for more information, there has to be some rational basis or probable cause to believe that these particular accounts we need to have more information for. And that's not in this record, right?
That is certainly true, Your Honor. The warrant just told the police basically find the people that seem most suspicious to you. And the police just initially selected all 19. Google pushed back. The police suggested selected 9. But the warrant itself doesn't provide any criteria. And
if it did, would it be more particularized? And isn't that what we should be saying in this opinion, for example?
Well, that would be a different way to achieve a Fourth Amendment, to rule that the Fourth Amendment was violated. That would be a very narrow resolution of this case. But yes, I do think that that alone is a sufficient basis to invalidate this warrant, even if the court disagrees with our broader arguments.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fagan?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. As I think Justice Jackson was just getting at, petitioner here is asking for an unprecedented transformation of the Fourth Amendment into an impregnable fortress around records of his public movements that he affirmatively consented to allow Google to create, maintain, and use. In doing so, he would make that fortress so impregnable that not even a judge's warrant for even a moment of the public location of someone who, again, affirmatively opted to allow Google to have those records and to access them would be available to law enforcement. That's a debilitating and counterintuitive reading of the Fourth Amendment that would impede the investigation of kidnappings, robberies, shootings, and other crimes, and would implicate any number of practices that I think opposing counsel kind of just waved his hands about, like tower dumps. Frankly, Mr. Chief Justice, I don't know how he concedes exigent circumstances, because under this court's recent decision, just this term in case against Montana, we need reasonable cause to believe that there's a necessary search, and under his view, this would be a search of everyone who has location history stored with Google, and I think he would have to say that we don't have reasonable cause as to each one of those people. And the way he is trying to achieve that counterintuitive result, I think, rests on two fundamental misconceptions that have been emphasized this morning. One is that this is like uploading your own content to a storage locker. Even Google doesn't treat it that way. If you see it, if you look at Joint Appendix 55, you'll see that Google separates out user-created content from other kinds of content. The second main misconception here, if I might just continue for one second, is that this would implicate all sorts of other types of data in which the court has found more of a reasonable expectation of privacy, like email. Location history is different. I'm sorry, Justice Thomas.
Mr. Fagan, would you address Justice Alito's point as to this being an advisory opinion?
Frankly, Your Honor, we attempted to warn the court about that in our brief in opposition. If the court wishes to dismiss the case as improvidently granted, we'd be fine with that. I do think there's really no chance the opinion here would make the officer's actions here unreasonable. Petitioner's suggesting now some kind of new kind of warrant requirement exception to the good faith exception. I don't really understand how that would work or what the contours of it would be, and I don't, like, what does it mean to have a new kind of warrant? At bottom, we just don't think there's anything that's going to happen here other than an affirmance. So you would essentially have something that looks like an advisory opinion. I mean, I suppose the court could say that the theoretical chance that something might happen is enough to keep this case alive, but I don't think that makes a great deal of sense.
Additionally, the policy, Google's policy, has changed, and would you compare that policy to this and the effect of that change?
Do you mean the pushing out of location history so it's now stored on the phones?
Exactly.
Well, I don't know that it would make a Fourth Amendment difference if Google were still able to comply with these warrants, but Google has represented to us that as of 2023 and that change that it made, it is no longer able to comply with the warrants, and that makes the difference. Your Honor. But otherwise, if this were information that were exposed to Google, I think it's an important feature of the warrant here that Google is actually the one doing the filtering on Google's accounts. As to any account except for the 19 that were additionally returned, and of course they were all anonymized, and they were truly anonymized. Their expert, if you look at page 288 of the Court of Appeals Joint Appendix, admits he wasn't able to specifically identify even the three people he was talking about. But as to everyone else other than the 19, they might as well not have existed from the government's perspective. And even Google didn't really learn very much about them other than that they were not within this 150-meter radius circle during that particular hour. I question whether that is an invasion of their reasonable privacy expectations. I think clearly not under this court's decision in Knotts. That's a public place. These were public movements.
Counsel, if I could interrupt.
Sorry.
One of the central concerns that's been voiced, of course, is what's to prevent the government from using this to find out the identities of everybody at a particular church, a particular political organization. What are the restraints that would prevent that from becoming a problem?
Well, number one, Your Honor, would be the Stored Communications Act, and I respectfully disagree with Petitioner's counsel. I mean, we have a somewhat different reading of the Stored Communications Act and exactly what it would require under these circumstances, and I know it's a statutory protection, but I disagree with counsel that it sets some kind of Fourth Amendment floor. The court basically rejected that position in City of Ontario against Kwan, which also involved the Stored Communications Act.
Well, put the statute aside, just in terms of the Constitution.
Putting the statute to the side, I mean, first of all, I don't think that there's any kind of categorical protection around something like a church. I mean, unfortunately, as you saw with Dylann Roof, we can have a shooting at a church. If he'd gotten away, I would have thought this would be a law enforcement technique.
So you don't think there's any constitutional protection from such organizations to be subject to focused surveillance that would cover everybody in the particular location?
Well, I think one avenue that the court has potentially held open, number one, is the amount of time for which the government could look. I don't know that the government could see everyone who came into a church at any time.
Well, if the services start at noon, they can go from noon to one, however long they take.
So let me make a few points on that, Your Honor. First of all, someone doesn't want it known that they're going to a particular place, like an abortion clinic, for example. They don't have to enable location history or keep it on while they're visiting that location. I mean, if there were a surveillance camera at a bodega across the street from the church, that could also see everybody who came in, and I don't think there'd be a claim to Fourth Amendment protection from government review of that. The second thing that I think I would say is that this has been the degree to which someone can really be located in a particular location, I think, is somewhat overstated in this case. If you want to look at the sealed volume of the Joint Appendix Volume 3, you'll see that usually there's a fairly wide confidence interval of close to, you know, like 30, 40 meters for everyone. So, and that's only, that only describes a circle with a 68% probability of containing them. So it's difficult to know exactly where they are.
I mean, we can't rely entirely on good faith, but the point is not that they're looking for a particular individual, but they want to have a catalog of the people who go to a particular location. And it seems to me that that's a realistic problem.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I mean, that can't really happen under the Stored Communications Act.
Well, again,
and
put the statute to one side and just focus on the Constitution.
Okay, and the second thing I'd say is, you know, I would focus on this particular case and in every case in which this has come up. The government has gotten a warrant because it's just easier to get Google to comply if we do get a warrant. And if you want to put the warrant aside, Your Honor, I do think that what really matters here is that people have affirmatively opted in. Only one-third of active Google account holders do
that.
So
to prevent surveillance of sensitive locations, you have to rely on the fact that people are going to turn off something that many, if not most, people find is an important service.
Well, Your Honor, I do think if you wish to conceal that you are at a particular location and you are effectively shouting and broadcasting your location to Google, and that Google is creating, maintaining, using for any number of its own purposes those records, I mean, Google could send you an ad saying, hey,
Fagan,
I see you go to...
Mr. Fagan, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I got to think the answer to the Chief Justice's question is yes. This isn't a search. We don't think it's a Fourth Amendment search at all. You don't need a warrant. And yes, if we want to determine everybody who is at a church or a political rally or the abortion clinic or anything else like that, we can do that. As long as we can get Google to comply. Oh, and we might have a few tools besides warrants to get social media companies to comply with governmental requests.
So I do think that effectively is our answer, Justice Gorsuch. Okay. You're not walking away from it. I'm simply noting two very important features.
I understand that, but that has to be your answer. And then there's a little tension in your argument as well. You're saying the sky will fall if you can't do this. That you started off with that. That was the very first point you made, how important this is. And then in the next breath, you said that Google can no longer provide this information because it has reconstructed how it operates. Can both things be true?
Yes, Your Honor. And here's why. I think a lot of the arguments that are being made here today and are made in the briefs, if accepted, and I think, again, this is something Justice Jackson was getting at, would have a debilitating effect on a number of other law enforcement techniques.
Like looking at email.
So email, Your Honor, we get a warrant for email.
But again, you don't think you need one because they broadcast it, as you say, to Google. It's subject to very similar terms of service.
That's not correct, Your Honor. We view email differently, and there are several reasons.
How about Google Documents? How about photos?
We view all of those differently.
So it's
just
location data that's different?
Yes.
Okay.
And this Court has made clear that it's different. So in Knotts, the Court makes clear that...
Could you just... footnote that answer. Are they different because you treat them differently, or are they different because something in your theory doesn't apply to them?
Your Honor, I was just getting to that. So we think they're different because the Court has always treated, like, the contents of one's personal thoughts as recorded differently from one's exposed public location, which is all that's at issue here. At least
How about a calendar?
So your calendar, I also think, would be different from your location history, because a record, your own personal updated calendar of where you've been. And there are several reasons for that. I think the Court has made clear in Knotts that exposing your public location for 2 hours, you don't have a privacy expectation in that. And that contrasts sharply with cases like Ex parte Jackson about physical letters, or even a case like Katz, which is about telephonic communications. Second, I think that's consistent with the original understanding of the Fourth Amendment. Justice Thomas gets into this a little bit in footnote 8 at page 351 of his opinion in Carpenter about how the original focus of the Fourth Amendment was protecting personal confidences.
He was a dissent there, though.
On this particular point, Your Honor, I don't think there was.
Yeah, but Mr. Fagan, I do think that Carpenter seems quite relevant to this. What you're now saying is location is different from email and photos and calendar appointments and everything else that people give to Google. And the reason is that location is just different because people just think that everybody knows where they are all the time. But I would have thought that Carpenter had something to say about that.
So one point, and then I have three different reasons why this case is different from Carpenter. But let me just jump to the three reasons because that's what you're asking about. Number one, we did exactly what Carpenter instructed us to do in this case. We got a warrant. Number two, I do think Carpenter and Jones.
But you're saying you didn't need a warrant. So I mean, I think the question is your theory, not what you did out of the goodness of your own heart.
Putting the warrant, which I think is the easy way to resolve this case, to one side. I think there are two key distinctions between this and Carpenter. One, in Carpenter, you had essentially the creation of CSLI, you know, cell site location information, as the price of even having a cell phone, which the court had said in Riley was a device that basically nobody can live without. That's not the case here. You have people affirmatively.
Is that the standard, that nobody can live without this standard?
That's the one fixed point that the court has given us. But here we're a long ways away from that, because even one-third of active account – of only one-third of active Google account holders bother to enable location.
So where's the line if 80% – enabled this, would that make it a different case?
I think that would be much closer to Carpenter, because I think, if I'm recalling correctly from Riley, it's something like 90% of people have cell phones. But I certainly think one-third of active Google account holders, which is a fairly small percentage of the world's population overall, shows that people don't need this. You can use Google Maps without location history. You can use Google Maps even without a Google account. The second thing I would say about Carpenter is that although neither Carpenter nor some of the separate opinions in Jones, like Justice Alito's opinion that you joined, drew clear temporal lines, I do think both Jones and Carpenter, both the opinions in Jones and Carpenter, focus on detecting the patterns of life and long enough periods of location to show the patterns of life. I don't think 2 hours is enough to show the patterns of one's life. They might show that you went to a church once. It doesn't show that you're a regular churchgoer. It might show that you went to a doctor's office.
I guess one question would be, why would the only thing that you would have an interest in protecting is the patterns of one life, as opposed to the things that you do in one's life that you particularly don't want people to know about, such as going to a political event, going to an abortion clinic, etc.? It's like I can tell you a lot of things about the patterns of my life. What I really want to keep private is particular things that I might do, you know, on very discreet occasions.
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. One is, I think the fundamental insight of Knotts is that if you walk out in public and you walk into some sensitive location, then you are exposing all of that to public view. In Knotts, they were following people to private residences. They didn't follow them into the private residences, but they were following people to private residences through the use of a beeper and stopping outside the private residence. Maybe you don't want someone to know that you're having an affair, but if you have a beeper in your car under Knotts and they're following you for 2 hours, they will find that out.
Would your position be the same if you had picked up Mr. Chatry in his home?
If there's testimony at page 120 of the joint appendix from this court that shows that we couldn't locate which of the houses was his, even though he eventually did go to a house, because, as it turns out, because the confidence intervals were simply
your position would remain the same, regardless whether somebody was in his home at the time.
Your Honor, I guess I would make a couple of points. I think that we would argue that. I think the court could draw a distinction. And the reasons we would argue that it would still remain the same is, number one, we had no warrant. Number two, I think this would make this case somewhat like Caro, where it doesn't invalidate the law enforcement technique ab initio. It just means that someone with standing could suppress the information about the particular home. And number three, I think this is distinct from other home circumstances precisely because of the opt-in and the fact that the person is advertising the fact that they are at home, sharing that with Google, and Google could say, I see you go to church every Sunday. Maybe you'd be interested in this particular religious item. Google could say, I see you're often in the house on Saturday mornings. Maybe you'd be interested in this particular thing that could be delivered to your house on Saturday mornings. And so they are opting to share that information to get a purely voluntary service, and they're doing so, if you want to look at the terms of service, which we agree aren't controlling, subject to the full knowledge that Google, of what Google is doing with it, and the ability of Google to respond in good faith to law enforcement or to make any number of other choices like sharing with service providers, for Google that will expose that information to public view.
Mr. Fagan, really saying, I mean, you're leaning pretty heavily on the correct proposition that what you do in public view is not generally, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in, but now you're telling Justice Kagan really that if you go into a private home, it wouldn't be a search? I mean, if you trace location services, I mean, I understand in this case, and is that true that in this case you're saying you didn't pick him up in any home?
Well, Your Honor, he eventually stopped at the end of his journey away from the bank at a group of homes, but there's testimony, this is page 120.
But not inside the home.
We couldn't tell which home he was even in.
Okay. But you really are saying that you could track someone going inside a home. Justice Sotomayor asked Mr. Unikowsky about movements inside a home, movements to the bathroom, movements to the bedroom, all of that, if the confidence interval is narrow enough.
Your Honor, I think what I'm saying is two things. One, I do think we could have done that here because of the warrant.
But I think the question is that
Carol,
a search under your
Is theory? It a search? I think probably, Your Honor, I acknowledge that's going to be a much harder case for us.
But no,
I think
is
if we were
answer.
To argue that, I think I'd like to reserve the possibility that we could argue that it's not a search principally because of the opt-in and the broadcasting. But I fully accept that that would be a very, very difficult argument to sustain. Nothing in our argument in this case depends on it. And I'm not saying that's critical to our argument, and if the court thinks that that is a bridge too far, I'm fine with that.
Well, I was just except for it's totally inconsistent with your theory, but other than that.
Justice Gorsuch.
On the particularity side, Mr. Fagan, let's say you go to a hotel, and the warrant is search all the rooms in the hotel for the gun on the bedside, or the storage facility, search all the storage units for a particular contraband, or the bank, go search all the safe deposit boxes for the pearl necklace that's been stolen. What's the difference between those cases and this case, assuming that I have a term of service with the hotel, with the storage facility, with the a bank that says you can access these places from time to time for purposes that we agree upon, and of course you can do something with the government if the law allows it.
So, Your Honor, I think this goes to a somewhat under-theorized portion of the Fourth Amendment, which is the definition of a place. I think we often have an intuitive sense of what's a place. In particular, with an apartment building,
You would agree those warrants would all be impermissible.
I don't know about necessarily about a storage locker one. That would probably be impermissible. Certainly, we couldn't search every apartment in a building, both because homes are first among equals
Hotel rooms, bank safe deposit boxes, storage facilities. The warrants I've just described go search for the contraband, the gun, the pearl necklace. Okay or not okay? Are those sufficiently particularized?
Well, let me take them each in turn, because I think the analysis might be slightly different under each of those things, Your Honor. First of all, for the apartment homes, no, and I think that's...
Still haven't asked about apartments, asked about hotels, but...
I'm sorry, a hotel is the same, because the courts treated it as a home.
Okay.
And houses are specifically listed in the Fourth Amendment,
right,
and they're first among
equals. How about the other two?
Okay, I think storage locker, I think probably we could not do that, and I think we probably couldn't do a storage room, although it would depend how it's organized.
Like every storage facility in America, you know, with one of those awful rolling gates and a padlock at the bottom.
So let me explain why and why that's different from this case, if I could.
I'm just asking you, do you think that warrant would be sufficiently particularized, the one I described, yes or no?
I think it would be sufficiently particularized because it would describe what the government had basis to search for.
The government could
but
ask
what I don't think
the storage facility and require them to search every locker and 500 lockers for the contraband.
What I don't think is that it describes a discrete Fourth Amendment place in which to search for the things
okay,
that the government
so it's not particularized then.
So I think it's more about place than particularization there, assuming there's probable cause to believe that the area writ large is going to contain the contraband. If I could explain a little further on this, Your Honor, I think what makes the difference in some of these hypotheticals versus what we have here.
Well, first, I just want an answer to my hypotheticals, and then we'll get to here, if that's all right with
you. Your Honor, my answer to the hotels is no. My answer to the other two is very likely not.
Okay.
Yeah, I would need to know a little more about
okay.
it.
Okay. All right.
And now let me explain why.
And now turning to this, do you agree that Google had to query every single user's account?
No.
Well, you said
Do you mean query as like a synonym for
I'm using your word from page
sense?
41.
Oh, okay. Yes, I do agree Google had to query in that sense. I'm sorry. I thought you meant
and there are about 500 million users' accounts, right?
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay. All right.
I agree, and let me tell you why it's different. I think the reasons the hypotheticals but I apologize for misunderstanding your use of query as a synonym for search. The reason this is different is I think it's a lot about opacity and control. And what I mean by opacity is the separateness of the different spaces. And control is who has control over those spaces. Here is a case where I think, as the court recognized in Riley, can often happen. The physical analogies kind of break down to some degree. The court has been clear in Smith against Maryland.
Well, let's just stop there. Let's assume that these accounts are kept in, you can call opacity or whatever you want, but are kept in the same kind of discrete manner as your email is.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's the case here. I think
Let's assume it is. Let's assume that the Google user account, we've got a lot of briefs on this,
that they're
categorized similarly by user and walled off from other users, both the email and the location data. Let's assume they're similar in that respect.
Your Honor, if this were a record that the user created and uploaded, our answer to this case would be different. But in this case, this is a record that Google creates, Google software sends it, Google processes it, it runs its own algorithms to actually figure out what information it's storing. It is data that Google maintains and data that Google accesses for any number of reasons. If we were to have a physical analogy to storage lockers, and I'm not sure how useful these physical analogies are, it's like having a bunch of storage lockers where there's a glass wall in front of them instead of having an opaque door for each box. All the government is asking for here is to get in the room and look at the front of those storage lockers. I don't think that the limited amount that even Google sees at step one is going to be considered a search. And for, as I said earlier, from the government's perspective, all of those other storage lockers, if you want to call them that, and we're accepting that analogy for purposes of this answer, all those other storage lockers might as well not exist. For all the government knows, there are only 19 people who have their location
history. Mr. Fagan, is that because at step one, unlike the examples that we've been talking about, you don't know how many apartments there are. You don't know how many storage lockers there are. At step one, it's just like getting a list. There are 16 apartments in this building. Right? And that's why I'm appreciating a difference between the steps as the iterative process with Google goes forward. Step one is we have a bank robbery. Here's the bank. We would like to know how many cell phone accounts were in this radius during this period of time. Right? I mean, you don't have the names. You don't have anything more than that. I'm struggling to understand the step one problem, other than to figure out how the government came up with 150 meters and 30 minutes before and after. So can you start maybe by answering that question? Where does that numbers come?
I can't help your struggle with step one because I, too, don't see a problem with step one. But the 150-meter radius and the half an hour before and half an hour after were based on wanting to exclude – there's some testimony in the record about this. They did want to include the church because they had testimony about a suspicious car that had been parked at the church, and they thought the robber, as it turns out correctly, might have come from there.
So evidence was presented to the magistrate. The reason why we're making the circle this big to include these structures is because there could be some connection to this robbery.
I don't believe that evidence, that particular reason for including that was presented to the magistrate.
Okay.
No.
Just
explaining to you how they got 150 meters and half an hour before and half an hour after allows you some information about, for example, there was a reference, and the magistrate did learn this, to co-conspirators in the demand note, and you might want to see if someone dropped the robber off or someone picked up the robber afterwards, so you want to know more about the movements around it. The advantage the magistrate has that I think is difficult for a reviewing court to replicate is knowledge of local conditions and realizing that 150, if I could just finish the sentence, Your Honor,
sure.
150 meters in Midlothian, Virginia isn't likely to turn up the entire phone book.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Thomas, anything further? Justice Alito?
You've been asked quite a few questions that analogized what happened here to searches, old-fashioned searches, of physical places. So searching the room of everybody in a hotel. If that happened, I think there'd be an awful lot of angry hotel guests, all of those who had nothing whatsoever to do with the crime. Here, Mr. Unikowsky says, 500 million people were injured when there was a search for their data, even though it was completely anonymized. How many of those 500 million people have come forward to complain about anything like this, which may be going on every day?
Well, I think that's right, Jerry. I think that points up that if they did want to complain, that would be a separate Fourth Amendment standing question, of course, and I don't think that petitioner here can represent their standing, but one reason they wouldn't complain is, first of all, I don't think this would violate the reasonable expectations of privacy, even if the government were doing it. Second of all, Google was doing it, and it's no different from any number of other things that Google does for its own particular purposes.
Well, don't you think that makes a difference for Fourth Amendment purposes? The distinction between a law enforcement officer invading a physical space and a request to a company to conduct a search with which the company complies?
Well, not only do I think that, Your Honor, but I think the court has said that multiple times. If you look at cases like Oklahoma Press against Walling or Lone Steer, it's very different when an officer comes into the premises and looks around versus something that functions, although this had the protections of a warrant, in many ways it functioned like a subpoena in that it was the provider doing the filtering and the provider disclosing the records, which limited what the government saw considerably. The only non-anonymized information the government got was for three individual users. It didn't know anything about anyone in the sensor vault other than the 19 that were returned for step one, and as to them, it didn't know their identities. So I do think that's critical. But the argument that he's trying to make about step one, I think it's very important that it really does implicate tower dumps, for example, because it implicates any number of law enforcement techniques that might incidentally find data about someone else. Even a CSLI warrant, you might have a company that organizes its data by tower. And in order to find, let's call him Carpenter, in order to find Carpenter's CSLI data, the company has to search across all of its towers during the time period and figure out which ones are Carpenter and which ones aren't. It's going to learn everything about all its users, in theory. I mean, I'm sure it's using software to do this and having a filtering mechanism, just like Google did here. But it's going to learn everything about all its users for that period of time. I don't know how he'd distinguish that. For tower dumps,
Dumps are not before us. Emails are not before us. Calendars are not before us. Photos are not before us. I mean, I understand that if we're going to write a treatise on the application of the Fourth Amendment to the new digital world, we might want to include sections in all of those things. But none of those things is at issue in the actual case or controversy that is before us. You've heard some proposals about narrow theories on which the case could be decided that would, as I understand them, focus on whether there was a lack of probable cause or a lack of particularity at step two or step three. What would be the precedential importance of a decision like that, which turns on the particular warrant that is at issue in this case?
Well, Your Honor, unless the court upholds the warrant, I do think the court needs to reach the search questions in some way, because the court would have to address whether the warrant was even necessary. And I think, as I've tried to make clear to the court, a lot of the arguments that petitioner is making here, while those other techniques are not directly at issue, would have implications on a lot of those other techniques and would create a lot of litigation and have a potentially debilitating effect on law enforcement. But they could even affect such things as visual camera surveillance. But as to the specific question you asked about the particularity at steps two and three, I do think it was sufficiently particularized because you had geospatial and temporal coordinates that showed that these people might be either suspects or witnesses, and the government simply was able to obtain enough information to figure out which of them might have information or be worth identifying. And I think the court's been clear that those are permissible law enforcement interests. The court might say that I'm sorry.
No, let me just add, I don't want to take up too much time. Let me just ask one final question. Of all of the arguments that the petitioner has raised, which do you think would be the most disruptive of what everybody has understood to be the limitations of the Fourth Amendment up to this point? His argument that this is a general warrant, his argument that he had a property interest in this data that was collected by Google, his request that we treat this search by a company as if law enforcement officers were themselves searching through records? Which is the worst?
Is all of the above an option, Justice Alito? I do think the idea that you have a privacy right or a property right and even a moment's worth of location history could be debilitating to all sorts of types of visual surveillance. The agent theory could debilitate subpoenas. The property theory, I don't even know where the Fourth Amendment goes after that. And I do think a lot of these theories are, and the general warrant theory that Your Honor mentioned, I think would call into question how we do a lot of computer warrants. We often name the servers as the place to be searched. And I don't frankly know, and I don't think courts are well equipped to find out exactly how data is organized within a particular company, and I don't know whether we have to take discovery on that in every case where we seek a warrant and actually really go down to the nuts and bolts or the virtual nuts and bolts of how a company does this.
All right, thank you.
Justice Sotomayor?
A few questions. Number one, the Stored Communications Act, a violation, Mr. Unikowsky said, may be a violation, there may be criminal penalties for it, but it doesn't give a suppression remedy, correct?
That's right.
All right. Number two, you're saying everything would be horrible, but Carpenter has already said you need a warrant, correct, for data?
Correct? And we got a warrant here, yes.
All right. But you're saying I didn't need a warrant because it was a short period of time, assuming I disagree with that.
Well, Your Honor.
Just assume that, okay? There are three steps to this process. Were the three steps approved by the warrant? I read the warrant, but now I've forgotten. Were the three steps approved?
Yeah, the three steps were all laid out within the warrant itself.
But the one who made the choice at step two and step three was Google, not a magistrate, correct?
Well, Your Honor, the warrant required the government to make reasonable efforts to minimize between steps one and two and
well,
steps
usually,
two and three.
Isn't it, I thought that if, for the foreign checking system that we have, that, magistrate judge says you have to minimize as you're doing it, but come back to us if you want a greater scope. Correct? And here you went from 30 minutes to 2 hours, and you didn't get a magistrate judge.
That correct? Was expressly authorized within the warrant. The warrant's parameters said that step two would be an hour before and an hour after the robbery.
Okay. I thought it was 2 hours. Maybe I misunderstood.
That's a total of 2 hours, Your Honor.
I see.
1 hour
right.
before, 1 hour after.
That.
The original was an hour, half an hour before, half
there
an hour
are,
after.
I understood, many jurisdictions in which the government is going back at step two and step three, correct? That's not much of a burden.
So,
if you've gotten step
Your Honor,
one and you can explain your reasons for why you're narrowing the warrant and why you need it at step two, you could do that.
We could do that, and with more recent warrants, the government has done that. Obviously, this was a Virginia warrant. But just to defend this warrant for 1 second, I think the court recognized in Scott, which is a case we cite in our brief, which is under the Wiretap Act, not directly a Fourth Amendment case, but the same principle applies.
Now, the value isn't there in our saying something like or deciding we need a warrant. It has to be particular as to time, place, time. And it has to explain the reasons why those limitations are reasonable, because that's always a part of the warrant search. And wouldn't that have value for the dispute that's going on around the country and between and among judges, even on this court? Some said some took your position that there's no right of privacy whatsoever and you don't need a warrant. Others have taken the position that you need a warrant, but you don't need much supervision from the magistrate judge. There is value in our setting the parameters of this process, isn't there?
I think if the court were to say something about warrants, that could have value, and I'm not going to claim that the sky is going to fall if we had needed a separate warrant at steps 2 and 3 and a total of 3 warrants. We've actually done that in more modern times. But what I am saying is that I would caution the court against saying that that warrants can never include any kind of discretion like the warrant did here.
We don't need to say that. If all we said was you generally need particularity, the way you do in any situation, you have to give enough to say there's a reasonable probability or fair probability, I think is our language, that evidence is in a would be disclosed, and what it's a limited search to these times and places, and you have to do it at each stage of a warrant.
Your Honor, I think we met all of those requirements here.
I don't even know if we need to go that far, but you would not be troubled by that rule.
Your Honor, you're simply describing what the Fourth Amendment requires.
And all right, that's exactly
laid out in our brief. We think the Fourth Amendment satisfies those requirements. Our warrant satisfies those Fourth Amendment requirements.
I'm not quite so sure of that because you don't explain why it's narrow, but that's a different issue.
Well, Your Honor,
all right, sorry.
Justice Kagan.
Mr. Fagan, I'm going to give you one of these physical location hypotheticals that you're going to resist, but you'll have a chance to tell me why it's different. But I want to understand your theory, and the easiest way for me to do it is through this. So let's go back to what Justice Gorsuch said. Let's use the storage locker, and there's a storage locker facility in town. It has 500 storage lockers, and they have a relationship with the police chief, so that the police chief can come to them and ask the storage locker manager to search all the storage lockers for particular things that the police chief needs. So the police chief goes to the storage locker manager, and he says, we're looking for somebody with a particular kind of weapon. You know, we're looking for somebody with a Glock. And the manager goes through each of the 500 lockers, and he comes back to the police chief, and he says, I've got a list for you. We have 8 lockers that contain a Glock. And now we're going to have a further conversation, you and me, the manager and the police chief, about which of these 8 you really want, all right? And they do that. So in that situation, how many of the lockers would you say have been searched, and how should a warrant respond to that? In other words, have 500 lockers been searched? Have 8 lockers been searched, or have 0 lockers been searched?
I think some of that might depend on exactly the circumstances under which the proprietor of the storage facility was permitted to go into the storage lockers, because that might set some of the parameters of the reasonable expectation of privacy, or at least inform them. I also think it's distinct from the circumstances we have here because you actually have someone who more plausibly could be seen to be acting as a government agent than the recipient of a warrant or a
no, what I'm saying is just assume that the relationship is similar to the relationship between Google and the government, and just assume that the terms are similar to the terms that Google has with its customers. So all of that is the same.
So
500 lockers searched, 8 lockers searched, 0 lockers searched.
Your Honor, I think to the extent we're talking about physical objects that are put into a storage locker that is expected to remain locked except when the user comes and wants to take something out of it, I think we might say that was a search of all the lockers because someone went in and looked in every single locker.
And so what would you need for a warrant for that search?
I think we'd need probable cause that there was going to be a Glock in one of the lockers, but I think
so you couldn't get it for all 500.
I am uncertain that would be valid for the reasons I was discussing with Justice Gorsuch, in that those might all be separate Fourth Amendment places, and we'd need specific probable cause as to each. I don't think that's true of the database that Google maintains.
Okay, so what is the difference in your view?
So I think the difference in our view is, first of all, to the extent that I heard opposing counsel, and this is in their brief, just suggest that Google's database is quite large. I don't think that in itself is a problem. I mean, obviously you could get a warrant to search a large house where the rooms are accessible to one another, or a large file room, even if it's physically separated across multiple rooms in a facility. I think the main difference here is that Your Honor, here I maybe am going to resist the physical analogy a little bit, but I don't think that these are the same thing as discrete storage lockers. These are more like storage lockers that don't have the set of expectations that I was just positing in answer to your hypothetical, and really are like a bunch of storage lockers with a glass wall. You could imagine, Your Honor, a coat check where we know that somebody dropped off drugs at the coat check, and we know what the person's name is. We don't know the coat check number. On their view, we couldn't get a warrant to go look at all the bags for the ID on the bag for the ID matching the person who dropped off the bag, because those would be unnatural bag searches that would be unlawful under the Fourth Amendment, and so we'd wind up searching everybody's bag. I think this is somewhat addressed, somewhat obliquely, I suppose, by the citation we have on page 44 of our brief to Chapter 8 of Professor Lefebvre's treatise, which allows for, even in a bailment situation — we don't think this is a bailment situation — but even a bailment situation, there's general agreement among courts that the bailee, the person with possession of the property, can look at it on behalf of law enforcement within the terms of the bailment. And here, what you have — again, we deny that it's a bailment, but if you want to analogize this to some kind of bailment scenario like you might have with the storage lockers, we'd still be within the terms of the bailment, because Google wasn't doing anything other than stuff that Google could already do.
Thank you, Mr. Fagan.
Justice Gorsuch? Justice Kavanaugh?
You always get a warrant, you said, and the states always get a warrant. So in terms of practical problems that would ensue, I gather there would be no practical problems. I understand your legal theory, but no practical problems from our saying that a warrant is required. Is that accurate for these particular kinds of warrants?
Your Honor, if the court were to say that this warrant was fine, we have no —
That wasn't my question.
I mean, Your Honor, I think it is a huge caveat.
The question was, are there any practical problems that you want to identify with
getting a warrant in particular?
Yes.
And
I assume the answer is no, because you've many times today said we always get a warrant in response.
Your Honor. My answer is no, but I would worry about an opinion that —
How we say that, I get that.
What you say.
Yes.
But like, I don't think we've had practical problems getting the warrants we need in these cases.
And then if a warrant's required, it comes down to how particular, I think, correct? It has
yes,
to be indescribable. I think you're going to agree with this, but I just want to get this out there and you tell me. There's a big difference between the issuing judge and the reviewing judge. That's the good faith. And the issuing judge, it seems to me, we should set some parameters, reasonable temporal scope, reasonable geographic scope, but then we trust issuing magistrates around the country to implement those rules. When it comes to the reviewing judge, we don't micromanage in second-guessing what the issuing judge did, so long as it doesn't exceed, you know, certain bounds that we've set forth. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what should we say if we say reasonable temporal and geographic bounds for these kinds of geofence warrants? Is that all we need to say? You want us to say the ones in this case? Should we get into this case, or should we just say it has to be reasonable temporal and geographic bounds and send it back to Justice Alito's first question? We're at the reviewing stage, not the issuing stage here.
Your Honor, I think that would probably be the better course, because, you know, I think what this Court's centuries, frankly, of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence teaches that it's difficult to put a ton of meat on the bone of reasonableness in this context, or probable cause, or reasonable suspicion, or any of these standards.
Yeah, and this is particular. How particular, you know, is 150 meters okay, 200 okay? It strikes me micromanaging that's going to be problematic, and it's really problematic when you're distinguishing the issuing judge from the reviewing court down the road, given what we've said, reviewing courts have to be extraordinarily deferential.
Yeah, and I think the court could direct some attention to the magistrate about, you know, not wanting, as I was suggesting to Justice Jackson, drawing parameters that under local conditions are likely to turn up much more than the government needs.
But exactly. Exactly. If we say things like that, that should, we trust the issuing judges around the country who do this every day to make.
You should trust them, Your Honor, and frankly, our incentives are perfectly aligned with theirs, because when we're seeking a warrant like this, we don't want more information than we really need, because that just increases the noise-to-signal ratio and makes these more difficult to actually find the criminals. I believe there is some suggestion from opposing counsel that often these warrants get abandoned or quashed, and they don't really turn up much evidence of crime. And that may be because some law enforcement agencies, I'm not impugning any specific one, we have many wonderful law enforcement partners, aren't drawing the parameters narrowly enough to even help themselves. So everyone's incentives are aligned here.
Thank you.
Justice Barrett?
So you described Mr. Unikowsky's position as maximalist, but there's a risk of the government's position being maximalist the other way. And I think, you know, two particular concerns are the ability to track into private residences, and you didn't concede that. The other is calendar, photos, email. Did I understand you before to say that you are conceding that would be different and that would be a search?
Yes, and I do concede that tracking into a private residence without a warrant, I think, is a very, very difficult argument for us to make, and I'm frankly not sure that we would actually make it. I was simply noting that, unlike in Caro, where the court held that we would have needed a warrant,
sure, but you didn't rule it out.
I didn't want to categorically rule it out.
Right, but you are saying that you would need a warrant for calendar, photos, email.
Yes,
that would be a search.
Yes.
Okay.
And let me, I mean, I'm happy to explain why I think that would be.
I just wanted to make sure we had a crisp understanding of what the government's position was on that. So that's sufficient.
Yes, that is the government's position on both of those issues.
Justice Jackson?
Just really quickly, I think there's something about the iterative process that may matter. And so just taking Justice Kagan's hypo really quickly for an understanding of what is happening, tell me if the government is thinking about it in this way. You keep saying this is like storage lockers with glass fronts, with glass in the front of it. They don't have solid doors. Anyone can look and see what's in there. So step one is the government saying, tell us if by looking at these lockers, any include have bags in them that might have a gun in them. Give us the list of the ones or how many have that, I think is a sort of a step one concern. And then maybe step two is, once you've gotten that subset, open the lockers and, you know, see if there's really a bag or feel if there's really a bag. And then step three is open the bags inside each of the lockers. I feel like there's something happening with the way in which Google is providing this information in response to the government that may be requiring more probable cause or more particularity as you go along. So what is the government's thought about that?
Your Honor, with my continuing caveat that I think there's a limited utility in some of these physical analogies, I would kind of resist breaking it down exactly that way. I think step one, you know, if we want to use the gun example, step one might be more, okay, you've got a glass partition here. Tell us which of them have guns in them. Number two would be, okay, of that subset, continuing to look through the glass wall, you don't even need to open it for this because this is still stuff that is exposed to your view. Please tell us which of them have a gun and a box of ammunition. And then step three is, okay, for the two or three you found, please tell us who's rented the storage lockers.
Do you agree that you need more to get to each step? I mean, here, what criteria did the detectives use to narrow down the list from the 19 to the 9 to the 3 that were ultimately there? And wouldn't a particularized warrant need to have some criteria in it to guide law enforcement at each of these stages?
So, Your Honor, with apologies, I think I need to take a step back and say that I don't really view this as getting more particularized. I believe there was enough probable cause to that the original warrant was and the 19 people that turned up, probable cause to believe those people would be either witnesses or suspects. And then there's a question of how to figure out which ones to follow up on. So what you actually have here is a warrant that I think is fully particularized with probable cause the whole way
through. You could have gotten the 19 names from the beginning.
I think that we could have, but in order to maximize privacy, what happened here was that the warrant included a minimization requirement on the government at each step, which is akin to the kind of minimization requirement you see in the Wiretap Act.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, Mr. Unikowski.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to say a few words about why this was a search, a few words about the warrant, and then finally why the court should decide the case. So first, why this was a search. I welcome counsel's concession from the podium that if there was a search for something like something else in the cloud, like email or calendar entries or photographs, in that case, there really would be a search and a warrant would be needed. But although I welcome that concession, I just don't understand the distinction that is drawn between those types of data and this type of data for Fourth Amendment purposes, either under a property or a privacy lens. So under a property lens, a person's relationship to their location information is the same thing as the relationship to their photographs or to their email. It's in their password-protected account. Counsel suggested that the answer might be different because it's in some way raw data. It's sort of generated by your phone as opposed to sort of a creative writing. So first of all, it's generated by the person in the sense that you move around. And second of all, I don't understand what that distinction has anything to do with the Fourth Amendment. Just as an example, you know, your Fitbit or your Apple Watch might measure your heartbeat and that information might be transmitted into the cloud. I still think that's yours, even though it's generated by your autonomic nervous system as opposed to the fact that you've written a journal. It just seems to me that if you have control over the data, you can turn it on, you can turn it off, you can delete it. It just doesn't matter if it's created by taking a photo as opposed to by the fact that you've decided to go somewhere. Similarly, from a privacy perspective, I don't see why a photo you take outside is somehow more private than where you were that day, because you don't have an expectation of privacy in, like, the thing that you were seeing if you were outside, but you do have an expectation of privacy in all of your photos, and likewise, you have an expectation of privacy in everywhere you've gone. So I think that if the court accepts the government's concession that you have an expectation of privacy or a property interest in photos and emails, the same thing would be the case for location history. Look, as to the warrant, on the step one issue, you know, Justice Jackson suggested that what happened here is that the government received a list of like 19 different people that were in the geofence. But respectfully, I don't think that's what happened. What it actually got is all of the movements of those 19 people within that hour stretch. So it's a little bit like going into 19 apartments and taking a complete inventory of everything in the apartment, but not disclosing the person's name. Because if you look at the record, like all of those granular movements for that entire hour were exposed. And so that's why I think that the Ibarra case is directly on point here. You don't have probable cause to search based on someone's proximity to the crime. What happened here is each person's, what we regard as a virtual storage locker, was searched solely because of their proximity to the crime. And because their movements within the hour were exposed every 2 minutes, that's different from simply identifying which accounts were within the geofence. It's really exposure of information about them. And although it's nominally anonymous, the record shows it's actually quite easy a lot of the time to figure out exactly who a person is based on a relatively small record of their movements. But look, I've heard some questions from the bench today about steps 2 and 3. There's clearly a constitutional problem with those steps. I mean, as Justice Jackson suggested, the warrant wasn't particularized. There's no criteria given for identifying those people. In terms of how to decide this case, I think it would be a very significant case, giving a lot of guidance to the bar, if the court says, one, a search happened, and number two, at step 2 and step 3, at a minimum, there was a problem with the warrant without reaching some of the broader questions about general warrants or particularization if the court is inclined to resolve the warrant question narrowly, because the government has a lot of very striking arguments on the warrant issue that can have significant implications. One is that Google wasn't acting as the government's agent, so it makes a difference that, you know, Google pushed the button as opposed to the police. Another argument that's made is that the fact that software is conducting the search is constitutionally relevant, which could have revolutionary implications when, like, AI is monitoring everything we do as opposed to a human being. Also, the arguments that as long as something is nominally anonymous, that makes a Fourth Amendment difference, which also can have radical implications when de-anonymizing someone is very easy. So, like, all of these arguments that the government is using to defend the earlier searches could have very broad implications. So if the court believes that the warrant is unconstitutional at step two and step three, it has the option of just setting aside those broader questions and deciding the warrant issue narrowly and also deciding that's a search, that would be more than a broad enough opinion to be useful to the bar. And I guess on the final question of whether the court should decide the question presented, look, it's very hard to see how the court could decide a question like this outside the context of a motion to suppress. If the court says the good faith exception applies here, it'll apply in every single case. I mean, Justice Alito posed the question, what about all the other people, the 500 million people who were searched? Well, number one, they're not told. All these warrants are sealed. The reason the outcry doesn't exist is that no one knows that thousands of times per year their accounts are being searched. Second, a 1983 claim by any of those people against the detectives would clearly fail on qualified immunity basis. So really the only way these issues will be litigated is through a motion to suppress in a case exactly like this one. And this is a good vehicle to decide the case because there's an extensive evidentiary record. There's declarations from Google. There's live testimony from Google. You'll never have a case with a more detailed account of the technical aspects of the case than this one. And so that's why I think the court should decide the Fourth Amendment question in this case.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.